I think this podcast is mostly going to cover your founder journey. But before we dive into all specific questions, we like to understand the macro view from our guests. So I'm going to ask you that since you think that we all think that AI is going to be the backbone of, you know, the future internet, and we can see it happening, what do you think is the single biggest risk if we get it wrong? And what excites you the most if we get it right?
Yeah, I think both have the same answers, to be very honest. I feel like this, the thing that excites me the most and the thing that is the biggest risk is just the amount of proliferation that AI is going to have. Right? Like, a good example of this is the internet almost forms 70 to 80% of our lives in different ways. The way we communicate, the way we consume entertainment. But there are limitations on the internet, right? How we interface with it, what the internet can do, because it can only pass information to you. It can't really do actions. It can't think. It can't, like, really, you know, parse through intelligence and data and stuff like that. So the single most thing I'm most excited about is, like, 90% of our cognitive capabilities will be outsourced to something beyond us. Why that's useful is because just like any organization, right? All of us have run companies here. If you get a really good hire, just imagine how much more you can do. So, like, if you have an infinite hires, you know, whether personally at home or whether professionally at your workplace, you know, it's just going to unlock so much more productivity for the average individual that jobs as we know it will look very different in the future. The biggest risk is also over-reliance, right? The biggest risk is that whether we like it or not, if we're going to give 90% of our future time, money, economic relationships, etc. to something which is beyond us, it can either make mistakes that can be catastrophic towards us, or, you know, can snowball into mistakes that are catastrophic to, like, humanity as a whole. Or it can just be malicious, right? You can just have a bad employee that's out to get you. And these are unknown unknowns that we've never grappled with as a species. So it's going to be interesting to see. Like, the way I think about it is, this is the first time you have an alpha species that's more alpha than the human. So it's going to be interesting to see how our relationship with it evolves.
That's incredible. I think for all of us, these are some defining questions that we ask ourselves and ultimately got us to be interested in the space and jump in, right? So let's go back to the beginning here. What sparked your interest in the intersection of AI and also crypto?
Yeah, I think so. To understand this, maybe I'll talk a little bit about, like, my nature as a person. I've historically always taken the road less traveled, right? I didn't study computer science because I believed that I could teach myself how to code, which I did. I stumbled upon crypto when I realized that, you know, stock market arbitrage isn't making me money, so I need to find an asset which is higher volatility. I cold DM'd hundreds of people, and finally, like, Balaji Srinivasan took a shot on me and got me to work with him on some cool stuff when I was still in university. Similarly, I met folks like Sandeep, Kenzie, you, and a bunch of other incredible people in the crypto space. Right? It's just been hustle and, you know, a little bit of serendipity. So that's how I usually approach life. If I'm interested or curious about something, I just deep dive, go down the rabbit hole and see what I end up with. I was lucky enough to be working at a place that encouraged that, which was Accel, which is, I'd say, it's one of the best venture firms in the world. But what being at a great venture firm affords you is it affords you access. It affords you access to incredible people, incredible resources, incredible companies. And I think I use that a lot to my advantage. So when AI was just about picking up, right? When I remember when, like, diffusion models were still, like, you know, coming up and people were realizing there's this whole new system of neural networks which are generative in nature. I spent a lot of time just digging into it, talking to companies that were at that forefront. And that time it looked worse than a toy. It looked like people were trying to like figure out what's a cat and a mouse using like LLMs and stuff. And we were like, you know, this is useless. And I think over the course of those 2 years, the rate of change that these technologies evolved in, I could see the writing on the wall that this is going to be the next big thing, right? And next big thing, not just from a business outcome, but next big thing in terms of like gross human impact. Like everybody's life in some form or the other is going to be touched by this. So then I started really diving deeper into AI itself. But my ideals have always been that, you know, the open internet is how the internet should have been built. And the open internet, like we get a few shots on goal every decade on how to shape what the next generation of the internet will be. I think AI is the most important shot of goal in the future. And, you know, while people think of crypto and AI as two divergent technologies, I feel like AI is the tool and crypto is the ideology. And I feel like AI can go either way, right? It can go fully big tech, three large companies that run it all, or it can go, you know, bootstrapped from the ground up, community driven, community owned, and just something that, you know, can be much more controllable and transparent by the general population. And I feel like, you know, we're at this crossroads, and I felt this when I started Mira as well, is we're at this crossroads that if we don't take the right decisions now as an industry, as a group of people to really push AI in that direction, it can lead to pretty bad outcomes. So in that context, you know, that really sparked the idea of building something at this intersection or really diving into this intersection.
Have you watched Silicon Valley?
I have, yes.
Yeah, actually, I thought that, you know, just now you said about this, you know, AI, you know, how it went from, you know, kind of dumb to, you know, more sophisticated over 2-3 year time period. And then this, you know, open internet. It just like, you know, I felt that if Silicon Valley has like a continuation, you know, that TV show, actually, those guys will probably morph into AI and also open internet, which is a crypto project, you know, together in that direction also. It's actually pretty meta.
Makes two hottest buzzwords, you just slap them together and you have a TV.
But it totally makes sense though. That's, you know, that's also why, you know, a lot of us are, you know, got into it in the first place. You know, so what was the aha moment that actually led to the creation of Mira?
Yeah, I think, so I'm not a savant, neither are my co-founders. I don't think any of us really intended to build what we wanted to build. We basically said, we don't know anything. This is a new evolving space. The best thing we can do is, you know, get in the trenches and get our hands dirty. And that's what we did. We started building apps end to end, like all the way from like renting out bare metal GPUs till the consumer app layer to understand like what's working, what's broken. So we did like run our own GPUs, run our own vector databases, build our own pipelines, host our own models, build our own orchestration, build our own apps, etc. Right? And some of these apps did decently well. Some of these apps failed, but we kept running into the same problem for the apps that were successful. The apps that were successful was basically what was happening was you got them to a decent scale and then they just break. And the reason they kept breaking is because beyond the point, as more users come in, the edge cases increase, right? And AI is inherently a probabilistic object. So you can't really control the outcome for your consumer, no matter how much you try it, because you have to keep building more and more pipelines around it. And which is why then user experience just keeps dropping, right? Because suddenly now, out of every 10 responses you get, 3 or 4 of them are not good enough for you. And as we kind of dug deeper, this seemed to be a problem for a lot of other builders, not just us. It seemed like this idea of hallucinations and like bias in models was creating a lot of issues to a point where the amount of work it was taking just to build scaffolding around these models was a lot more than just building this as a standalone non-AI application, which is why you see a lot of people, at least on the frontier of consumer and the frontier of like enterprise, reverting back to like either very base layer AI or like no AI at all. They're like, this is not working on the most important things we wanted to work on. So at that point, we really believed and felt like this seems to be an important problem. And also this seems to be a problem that will continue to be a problem 5 years out. Because the big risk we didn't want to bear was solving something that is going to be solved by the market anyway. And this is what has happened, right? Every YC batch basically gets obliterated by OpenAI because they launched some new agent feature, which, you know, no one thought they would launch. So we felt like you need to find problems that one are big problems today and will continue to be big problems because of the incentives of these large organizations. And in our case, what are the incentives? Is that hallucination is effectively a feature and not a bug. Without the idea of hallucinations or expression, LLMs would not be able to do what they do today. Then they'd just be like any other software tool that picks between two deterministic outcomes. So it's like, you know, two sides of the same sword. It's just that most people lean into one side and, you know, have forgotten that the other side exists. So we felt like as AI kind of goes into more high consequence stuff, high consequence, for example, is like agents that handle real money, you know, things that are in high consequence fields like healthcare, etc. Hallucinations is going to become an increasingly larger problem. And you've broadly been right on this on a macro level. Like just yesterday, the CEO of Grok, the cloud company, they asked him like if there are going to be five AI companies that are the most important that haven't started yet, what would they be working on? And he said the most important company that will be working on hallucinations is a problem. So I feel like people who are like in the thick of it are also kind of coming around to say that this is going to be a big issue. And so yeah, we spent the last, you know, most of last year, I'd say, just focusing on this core problem statement, you know, with a few customers, with a few users saying, what can we do better to solve this specific problem? And we had a very interesting breakthrough sometime in September of last year, where we were able to build on technology built by Google Brain and Cohere and a bunch of others that basically used wisdom of the crowds as a tool to solve this. So very long story short, we will be able to use diverse AI models, you know, make them work together to reduce hallucinations as a problem and almost bring AI reliability up, you know, from a base level of like 70% to 97% in a bunch of our use cases. And that was a pretty big unlock. So we were pretty, you know, excited about taking that to market. And since we've taken that to market in the last few months, you know, we've seen incredible traction. Today, we have our ecosystem of applications serves about 3 million users cumulatively. They do about, and of these 3 million, about 600-700K at DAU. They do about, you know, 1 million to 1.5 million inference requests a day. So it's like pretty meaningful volume being processed from these, you know, customers and these applications. And we see like a pretty bright path to kind of getting more of this online.
That's great. How do you solve the hallucination problem? And also, who are your customers? And who are your future customers down the line?
Yeah, great question, right? So the hallucination problem, basically, there's this idea of the training dilemma. So hallucinations are intrinsic to how a model is built because a model hallucinates when it is given conflicting information. So then it can't decide what is the actual output in context of like the input it's provided. And conflicting information is often like a function of how it's trained. So our thesis was that if you use diverse models, and a diverse model here is a model from a different family. So GPT-4, Claude, Llama 3.3, DeepSeek, all these are diverse models because they've been trained in different ways. And if you make them collectively work together, so let's say GPT-4 creates the output, the other three of them verify it, or anyone else of them does it, and there's consensus on the verification, that means all three of them agree that this output is accurate in the underlying context, the risk that, you know, the probability that an independent model's hallucination is picked out is very high. And what that basically does is you can discard any hallucinated output to ensure that only, like, ideally non-hallucinating output goes out to the end user. And that's been, like, fairly, that assumption has held fairly true so far. In terms of our users, so we have a healthy mix of, like, Web 2, Web 3, and a bunch of users. On the Web 2 side, the segments that really, you know, stick out are software companies trying to cater to high consequence industries, right? Where you can't afford to get things wrong. So finance, health, education. So we have a few customers there. On the Web3 side, it's a lot of like trading bots. Bots that, of course, are handling a lot of money. And usually across this ecosystem, it's use cases that are high tail risk, right? High tail risk means that you might get something right 99% of the time. But if you get it wrong 1% of the time, the odds that you lose everything are really high for that 1%. So you don't want to take that risk. A good example of this is you give, let's say, $1 billion to a trading bot. It might make you 50% a year, but there's a risk that it clicks on an exploited contract and it loses all your money, for example. Right? So our technology works really well in those use cases where you don't want that high tail risk happening. So, you know, a real world example I can give you of what's worked is we have a customer actually called Delphi Digital. It's one of the largest like research firms in crypto, and they tried to launch their own AI copilot. It's called Oracle, and they failed. They tried multiple times, and the reason they kept failing was that the AI that they were using, which was GPT-4o, was not actually delivering accurate output. It was failing like 30% of the time, and their legal counsel told them that if you're releasing an investment advice product that makes mistakes 30% of the time, that's like 30% legal liability that's coming straight to you. So the risk of loss in case of failure is really high. So when they started using us, they saw that the 30% had come down to 1%, which was acceptable enough risk for them to really deploy this in production, which is currently being used today.
That's incredible, man. Congrats on that. With newer and newer models come out, does your solution have to like retrain on top of each new model, or, you know, does your product, your network, you know, can just, you know, swiftly switch over to new models?
So when the new Alibaba Gwen model came out, we had it up and running in 2 hours. So it doesn't take that much time. It's agnostic to the underlying model. It can keep switching in, switching out. Also, the trends in AI, like infinite context window, are more beneficial to us because then you can just hold the entire context in the network itself, right? I think the other question that I keep getting, which is important to kind of address, is as models get better, does your solution get less better, right? Because like models themselves get more reliable. I think the way we think about it is you have two types of businesses, right? You have one type of business that improves the current status quo, right? Which says, okay, the current status quo is 5%. I'm taking it to 10%. Or you have products that unlock net new markets. I think what we're doing, given where AI is constantly unlocking new markets. Because as AI gets better, we get better. We get significantly better. And as we get better, we can do things that were not possible before. For example, you know, Delphi's case, right? Delphi could not deploy before Nira was in the picture. Tomorrow, there might be something that needs much higher reliability, let's say in health or something else, that will not be able to deploy until we bring AI to a point where, you know, it can be deployed. So I think we want to be that accelerant that continuously, we want to be the first AI product all our customers use because they could not use any other AI product. That's a weird product.
Since, you know, this onboarding time seems pretty short, right? A couple hours for new models. Do you envision at some point you could have a consumer portal? Because right now the business model is B2B. Do you see that maybe down the line there will be like a B2C or maybe B2B2C type of a use case coming out so you can scale faster?
So yes and no. I mean, we have, it's I think a matter of focus. Right now, a core part of our focus is to just make sure the product is as good as it can. And we think about it as B2D, right? So we don't just sell to businesses. It's grassroots. Any developer can come and pick it up and use it, you know, just like how you would use it. So it's exactly the same as using an OpenAI API, right? It's OpenAI compatible. You don't even have to change the SDK. All you have to change is like the URL and your API key and you're good to go. It's as simple as that. I think in the future, we might explore a B2C option, which is more of like a consumer app directly. But we feel like we're already working with a lot of consumer apps and we don't want to like encroach on what they're doing right now because they're driving, at the end of the day, they drive volume to us, which is just good for us.
This is incredible. And hopefully you're also going to charge, right? Or are you charging already?
We are charging already. We are charging a lot less than we should be, primarily because we're still in like our testing phase and our beta phase. We do about, I don't want to exactly say the revenue number, but we do six figures in revenue and growing 100% month on month right now.
That's awesome. What were some of the biggest early day challenges that you faced when Nira was off the ground? Was there any like, you know, assumptions that turned out differently in the early days?
Oh, a lot. I mean, I think we took a big bet on RAG, which has not worked out, which has been like something that we, in hindsight, it was pretty obvious. But as a team, we built a lot of our tech infrastructure around RAG. But I feel like RAG has become pretty obsolete as a technology. And I think like a general comment here is I'm a first-time founder. This is the first time I'm doing it. I feel like we could have done a better job with focus. Like, we could have been here 6 months earlier if we had just done the right things and just done them and, you know, not touched anything else. But I think in the excitement of running a company in a very hot space, you want to do as much as you can, right? So, and sometimes I feel like doing nothing is better than doing everything. So that has been a big challenge. On the assumption side, one more big assumption that we took early on, which hasn't played out surprisingly, is that, you know, smaller models will pick up. You know, you'll have smaller specialized models that, you know, achieve parity in certain use cases. But I think broadly, the entire market just continues to reward larger models. So we've had to tweak our infrastructure and our pricing and a bunch of other stuff to kind of account for that.
That's super cool. You know, your background is really stellar. Excel, Amazon AI, BCG, Uber. I'm curious, how did those experiences shape your approach on building Mira, which is, you know, has a Web3 component, right? But previously your experience mostly in Web2. So what did those experiences shape, you know, your approach?
So yeah, just to clarify here. So I worked mainly at Excel and BCG. My co-founder Ninad, who's also co-founder, head of research, worked at Amazon AI and Uber. And our third co-founder, Sid, actually was the co-founder CTO of Stata Labs, which is a pretty big crypto liquid staking company, right? So I think from the tech side of crypto, we were covered because Sid has done it all. He's done everything from Ethereum mining to running liquid staking, etc. From the AI side, Ninad has seen AI for the last 10 years. So we really, really know how AI works and what are the pitfalls there. I think the one thing that we, what I knew about crypto coming in is that in Excel, I did a lot of crypto investments. One of the things, I've been close with Sandeep was also because we were part of Polygon's big raise back in 2022. But, and I've seen a lot of these companies kind of, you know, go through the good and the bad in the last few years. But I think what has really stood out as something that I didn't anticipate and the rest of the team didn't anticipate is just how quickly market structure in crypto changes and how quickly as teams you have to continuously adapt to what's happening, both, you know, on a price perspective, to sentiment perspective, to investment climate perspective, to technology perspective. And, you know, it's actually a lot easier to build in Web2 when you consider all these things. So I think that's been the big unlock that has happened for me in the last year. But I've also been in and around crypto in different contexts. So I've been investing in crypto since 2016, 2017, have, you know, had a lot of friends who've done decently well. A lot of them sit on my cap table now. So I'd say I'm crypto native enough to have a sense of how the pulse of the market works. But I think once I got in the founder's shoes, I think my knowledge going in must have been 5% or 3% compared to what it is now. So I think that learning curve has been really steep.
Yeah, this Web3 AI space is moving super, super fast. But you guys are doing incredible. That's really, really cool. If you had to make, you know, point to one decision that you made that changed everything for Mira, what would it be?
I really do think one of the big decisions that we made early on was bringing on Ninad as our co-founder. I feel like looking back, there is so much in deep AI research that we did not know about. And, you know, as we wanted to go more into being a first principles AI company, that set of skills became the defining factor of what Mira is today. So I think if we had not done that, we would have been an interesting dev tool company, but not have been able to do what we do today. So I think that's been the defining step in the trajectory of where Mira is.
How is Mira different from other decentralized AI infrastructure protocols like BitTensor, Jensen, Ritual, Sahara, etc.?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? So we wanted to go really narrow. The first thing we said is let's focus on one problem statement and do it really well. And that problem statement was just high trust, reliable intelligence, right? That's all we go after. Everything on our tech stack is focused on making sure that works for us. And what that means is that we can really either support or use a lot of these protocols. For example, Ritual, you know, the founders there are investors in Mira as well. And they're very close to them. So we are actually in the process of like integrating some of our tech into the Ritual chain so that users can use like Mira's AI API out of the box. BitTensor, I'd say, is its own beast. It's full stack. You know, we don't and BitTensor focuses a lot on the idea of like decentralized production of intelligence. For us, we focus on saying, here is a highly reliable AI API. You know, this is the reason for its reliability is two things. One is, of course, the core technology, but also that each of these individual nodes achieving consensus have like, you know, economic security around them, just like a blockchain does, right? The reason we trust a blockchain is because the validators who are validating a block have like a risk of loss in case of proof of stake and stuff. Similarly, in Mira, validators that are validating the integrity of an inference actually have risk of loss. That makes it even more reliable and traceable for any user using it. But for any developer using Mira, it's like a simple API versus BitTensor of kind of getting a subnet up and doing a bunch of things there. Jensen, I'd say, is a little different. It's a lot more focused on like training and building like compute networks. In that case, like we already work with like six of the biggest deepen networks to kind of plug into Mira as operators of nodes. So Ionet, Aether, Hyperbolic, Exhibits, etc. All of these guys run nodes on Mira, right? So we basically become a demand driver for them because instead of just using a base model, you can use like Mira, which is a lot more reliable and still get demand in your direction. And then Sahara, I don't know enough about. I do know they're a lot more data focused, but like I really can't comment a lot more.
So Mira raised $9 million from top VCs. Like, what did you learn from the fundraising process as like a first-time crypto founder?
What I know today is we were very lucky in the fundraising process. I think fundraising is a lot about timing. I think AI was hot. The AI was hot in general. Market structure permitted for large fundraisers. As a team, we just seemed to fit the bill for a lot of investors. And, you know, it kind of worked out. But even then, I didn't anticipate how hard it would be in two aspects, right? One is just talking to like 100 plus investors, you know, hoping that like three of them would close and then kind of building around that. But the next is even just all the legal work, right? I was an investor myself. And even then I like underestimated the amount of legal work that it takes. So as I think the big, like, if I had to like talk to myself a year ago when we actually did the fundraise, all I'd say is be more patient. Because I think that's like the defining characteristic of a good fundraise. And then there are other things, right? You can really plan your fundraise in a way that, you know, it's also the other thing is, in my mind, the pitch you give to the first investor you pitch to and the pitch you give to the last investor you pitch to are very different. So you have to really define the sequence of who you want to pitch to, because the last pitch is going to be a lot more cohesive and, you know, compelling than the first one.
How long did it take you guys from like, you know, starting to plan the fundraise, like, you know, figuring out your pitch and everything to actually closing like your lead investor?
Closing a lead investor was pretty quick. So we had two co-leads. We had Framework and Bitcraft. From starting to raise to closing, the first co-lead was like 15 days.
Oh, that's not bad at all. That's really good.
Yeah. And then the second co-lead was like another 15, 20 days. But I will caveat this by saying that I have both the co-lead investors who work with me and sit on my board. I have known them and like worked with them very closely for 4 years before this. So it was like, it wasn't that the 15 days mattered. It was like the 4 years before the 15 days that mattered. That's it.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So why do AI models struggle with reliability? And why is this such a difficult problem to solve?
So there are two reasons why this is a difficult problem, right? One is it's just intrinsic nature of neural networks to be probabilistic. Right? The whole idea of a neural network is it figures its way out through latent space. It's not like given a binary yes or no outcome, because you can do binary yes or no like traditional software and rule-based systems. And hallucinations is a problem cannot be solved at the neural network layer, which is very important to understand, because that's like saying I will teach a model how to think deterministically and probabilistically at the same time. It doesn't really happen. The second issue of why it's hard to solve is because the incentive structure. Hallucinations are still the most important feature of AI models. Without hallucinations, you would not have Midjourney. You would not have ChatGPT in the way it is. You would not have like Chain of Thought and DeepSeek R1. Because these are all byproducts of how a model thinks probabilistically and hallucinates. So in that context, I think it's very hard for people to define, it's very hard for people to define like in what context they want hallucinations and what context they don't. Right? Which is what makes it a really hard problem to solve. It's much easier for someone to say, I will solve hallucinations, period. And then, you know, go to people and say, now you can use this however you want. The other interesting thing here, which, you know, people kind of gloss over is, even if I solve hallucinations, right, as a centralized company, there is a big problem of trust. Because the way you solve hallucinations is by using other AI models. But how will you as a user trust that all models are not hallucinating at the same time? Right? Or that the user actually not using the relevant models in the first place. So you might be using and getting an output, but that output might actually still be hallucinated. So in that case, like you need to build these systems of, you know, trustless networks or whatever, like whatever you can build to get like trust into this API, because that's going to matter to like what your users believe and perceive of your product.
Can you explain how Mira's trustless verification layer works behind the scenes and why it's critical for AI reliability?
Yeah, sure. So I can like walk you through a single request, right? Let's take Delphi again, because it's like a relatable example. Delphi has an incredible report on Solana called Solana the Monolith, right? And I have a Delphi Oracle, which I can chat with to generate outputs and like talk with the report. So I go to Delphi Oracle and ask it, why does Delphi believe, as per this report, Solana is like a very bullish in 2025? And Delphi Oracle will basically come out with like five reasons based on the report, right? It'll say, the Delphi team believes Solana is like really valuable because it's going to hit 10,000 transactions per second. Its ecosystem is valued at $10 billion, you know, yada, yada, yada. You give like five other points. Each of these points is what we call a functionally verifiable claim. That means that each of these points has a binary yes or no associated with it, right? Because 10,000 TPS is either yes or no. There's no like maybe, right? Because it's a fact. So what Mira does is our core technology involves this idea of binarization and sharding. Binarization is another LLM-based technique that is able to extract all these functionally verifiable claims. For example, is this true? Right? Is this fact true? Is this fact accurate in the given context? Does this code run? It can be a bunch of different things. Now, every time a functionally verifiable fact is extracted, we do something called sharding, which is very similar to how parallel blockchains work. So that single shard is sent to an independent group of LLMs. So in this case, let's say Solana has 10,000 TPS, right? That's going to be sent to an independent group of LLMs that we call an ensemble. So usually right now we use a 3 out of 3 consensus. So let's say in this case, it will be an instance of GPT-4o, instance of Claude, and instance of Llama 3.37 405b. Now, each of these three models is given this input saying, verify whether this fact is true. And each of these three models is also given access to the underlying report. And they will independently arrive to a conclusion of whether this is true in context of the underlying report. So, for example, GPT-4o will take the statement and check it with the Delphi report and say, okay, this fact actually exists, right? And only if all three of them agree to this, that means have 3 of 3 consensus, is the fact validated and then added to the final output. And the final output is then reconstructed based on this, saying this fact is true, this fact is true, this fact is true, etc. And then that is sent to the end user. What this ensures is there are 3 different checks in place where if in case a hallucination exists, it can actually be picked out.
So Mira's ecosystem is growing. Can you share some of the most exciting AI agent use cases, products and projects being built on Mira?
Yeah, I think the most exciting one right now is just Clock. So Clock is our multi-chat LLM product, which is built on the Mira stack. It's done quite well. It's almost hit 3 million users now across different geos. You know, few of them are bots, of course, but like meaningful users is like 2.5 million who are actually, you know, interacting with it week on week and, you know, doing real requests. We have Ferre, which is a really cool one, which is an AI meme coin agent. We have Cabbage, which is another meme coin trading system. Then we have a few interesting Web2, you know, products and companies being built. So we have Astro 24/7, which is an AI agent for astrology. That also has about 1 million users now, you know, on the App Store. We have Amor, which is a character AI style, you know, chatbot, but which is like a lot more safety gated. So because of our verification, you can ensure that NSFW content and a bunch of that stuff does not pass through to the end user, because that's a big risk right now. I don't know if you guys have seen that story, but a bot on character AI basically convinced a teenager to commit suicide. So it was like a big deal on like the safety of AI and stuff. And we actively ensure that our system does not allow that to happen. So in that context, you know, we have quite a few of these interesting products already live, and, you know, a bunch of them coming live over the course of the next few months. It gets us excited.
Beyond hallucinations, you know, AI also struggles with biases. How does Mira ensure that AI outputs are not just accurate, but also are fair and unbiased?
Yeah, I think bias is a very tricky one, right? Because bias is oftentimes a function of the beholder. So bias is usually like a good example of this is Tiananmen Square. And the Tiananmen Square massacre, for example, is not shown on Chinese models, but shown on American models. Or like border disputes, right? How do you know a border dispute is accurate or not? So what we do, and from a bias perspective, is oftentimes allow for users to allow for the developer or the user of the API to define context, right? So for example, if you are someone in India, you will want to define India's border as including Kashmir. But if you're someone in Pakistan, you don't want that border to include Kashmir for India. And there are like hundreds and hundreds of different examples like this. So what we give users on the bias side is we don't define the bias for them, because that's a recipe for disaster. But we give them the tools to configure their own bias, right? You can call an API and say, this is the kind of, I want my model leaning in this direction versus that direction. And our output verification system, again, goes into use to ensure that that alignment is maintained. So, you know, we believe that we are a general purpose alignment protocol in that degree. And then we allow our users to kind of really define what that alignment looks like. If there's conflict in alignment, the output won't go through, right? Because then one of the models will fail and then the consensus kind of fails out there.
So Quark is built on Mira's decentralized infrastructure. Why is allowing users to interact with multiple LLMs important?
Yeah, I think so. The Clock team has an interesting insight, which is that, you know, why would you want to have, and I have this issue too, right? I have subscriptions to OpenAI, Anthropic, and like three other AI companies, and just burning a hole through my pocket. Like, why can't you just do it in a single interface and also kind of get, you know, incentives for it or rewards for it? And I think the Clock team has done quite well in really building that out in a way that, you know, works well. There are, of course, it's early days, a lot more features to be added to get to parity. But the insight there is that a lot of AI features on the consumer front will be commodity. And you can just get them by API. And we saw this with deep research, right? OpenAI released deep research in 2 weeks. Perplexity had an open source deep research out. So then what's going to matter is really distribution and marketing and GTM. So I think that's going to be, that's an interesting approach to say, okay, if, can you use, you know, can you use like open source technology to then drive just better GTM and compete with some of the incumbent players? And because they're using our infrastructure, they get two benefits. One is our AI is broadly cheap because we're using a lot of these deep in networks that, you know, basically undercut a lot of pricing. And second is that the AIs are just a lot more reliable than what you'd expect from anyone else.
Can you share how Mira points fit into the broader tokenomics and incentive structure for Mira?
Yeah, I mean, tokenomics wise, Mira points will give some sort of reward in the network once we go live. You know, we're in the process of really having those conversations and stuff, so can't talk too much about it. But it's a way to reward a bunch of our early users and community.
How does Mira help open source AI model developers monetize their contributions?
That's an interesting one, right? I think the biggest problem in monetizing AI for an open source developer today is the lack of a single market. Like what Amazon did really well back in the day was created unified distribution for all small sellers, and that let them kind of just focus on one channel and like grow into that. If we can drive enough traffic and enough demand to Mira through a single source, then the best way for model developers to monetize is actually going to be just to publish on Mira, right? Or to work with Mira to get a share of their traffic. So I think that's what's pretty exciting. We're actually working with a bunch of like mid-size fine-tuning and like small model development companies to kind of get their models published on Mira over the course of the next few months. So that's like an interesting thread we're trying to pull. Too early to say how that ends up, but it's exciting.
Where do you see AI verification going in the next 5 years? And where do you see Mira fitting into this in the future?
Yeah, like I said, right, beginning of the call, I think AI is just going to get more and more integrated into what we do daily. That also means it's going to get more and more, two things are going to happen. It's going to get more responsible for a lot more higher consequence things. Like we'll be effectively outsourcing all our health to AI. We'll be outsourcing nutrition to AI. We'll be outsourcing like, you know, key economic decisions to AI, right? So I think my ideal for Mira is that we become the driving force behind a lot of these high consequence decisions. That's one. The other thing I do see happening is just AI also is getting more complicated, right? AI is moving from simple translation to thinking or reasoning, which is like thinking in steps and a bunch of stuff. So we are missing a lot of that feedback. We will be missing a lot of the feedback loop that exists today. For example, Sachi, if you chat with Claude today, every time it gives you an output, you can kind of re-prompt it with like information and kind of guide it to an answer. But if you ask DeepSeek Tarvan something, it's just going to like burn a bunch of tokens and give you the final output. But if it's made like one small assumption mistake or one small, you know, factual error at the start of the chain, it's going to just like, it's turtles all the way down, right? It's going to ruin the rest of the chain. So we're going to struggle a lot as an industry with finding mistakes in the process at which AI does things, not just in the output, which is, I think, going to be really important.
Okay, awesome. I think we are done with all the heavyweight questions. And now I'm going to ask you fun questions. So this is the last section of our pod where we try to understand your personality as a founder and generally your outlook towards the space, but with very quick answers and short answers. Are you ready?
I hope so.
Yes. So what's that one AI tool you think you are getting overly dependent on?
Right now, it's OpenAI O3 Mini.
Okay. What's a startup in the crypto and AI space except Mira that excites you and why?
I think the most exciting one for me is like the category. I think decentralized training is the most interesting. I think it's the most ambitious of them. And the people who are trying to do anything there is just like really, really hard. So, and there's some incredible companies. I think Noose, Prime Intellect, all these guys are phenomenal teams. So I did those guys.
Yeah, that's a nice answer. The hardest part about being a crypto founder?
Incentive misalignment.
Elaborate.
I think there are different games you have to play to be successful, but you can't be successful without playing all those games. So you can't pick and choose what you have to do. You have to do everything.
Incentive misalignment. Okay, I like that. What is that one habit that keeps you super productive?
Sleep.
How many hours do you sleep?
8. I try to sleep 8 hours every day.
Yeah. Okay. Brian Johnson will be very happy to hear that. If you had to describe your leadership style in one word, what is it?
Lazy.
Why?
I'm genuinely a lazy person. So I try to just like hire great people and get them to do things for me. And that's usually like counterintuitive to a lot of founders because they want to like control everything. But I feel like you, after a point, you really can't control everything. So I try really hard to do that.
So the positive side is that you're trusting then. You're trusting with your...
Yeah, I mean, I would want to, if I'm hiring like great people, you have to like trust them to execute.
What's the most difficult hire? Who was the most difficult hire for Mira?
Continues to be the most difficult hire. A marketing lead.
I don't know why I get that answer from like so many founders, considering there are so many marketing people out there.
I think why? Because if someone is a great head of marketing, they would be a founder.
Yeah. Okay.
It's as simple as that.
So they turn into like builders themselves. Yeah, probably. Okay. I think this you already answered. I don't know. One prediction for AI in the next 5 years.
Yeah, I wouldn't be I wouldn't be surprised if like we do not see screens anymore in the next 5 years. There'd be some sort of like net new interface.
No screens. Yeah, I'd like that. What is harder, Karan? Raising money or hiring great people?
Hiring great people.
Biggest red flag when hiring someone?
Don't proactively come with suggestions and ideas.
Don't proactively come with suggestions and ideas.
If you're really interested in working at an early stage company, you need to like go above and beyond. Like no one's going to give it to you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you come so it's not a red flag.
No, it is a red flag if they don't come proactively.
Oh, if they don't. I don't know why I heard that if they come. Okay, so if they don't come. What is your guilty pleasure when you need a break from work?
Honestly, I don't know. I haven't had a break in a while. I think my guilty pleasure is sleep because the rest of the time I'm working.
Yeah, that makes sense. And this is like our standard question for most founders. What is your advice to 10 years? No, I think you're very young. 7 years younger, Karan.
I think this is very cliched, but the more I think about it, the more true it is just take as much risk as you can. Life is extremely asymmetric.
Mm-hmm.
You only get so many shots on goal, and most of those shots come in your like late teens and early 20s and mid 20s.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'd say a lot of us, including Kenzie, Sachi, all these people would not be where they are if they had not taken like extremely high risk decisions at some point early in their career. Right? I think that's the most important thing people should continue to do.
Yeah. Like not taking risk is the biggest risk, right?
Especially now, I feel AI is just so divergent.
Mm.
You take like a risk, then the risk is that AI is going to like take away all your economic value.
That's so true. That's amazing. Okay, great takeaways, Karan, and amazing talking to you once again. And I hope we keep talking again and again to know how Mira is shaping up. Thanks, Kenzie and Sachi, for joining, hosting this podcast. Love your backgrounds. Go and enjoy some sun outside. And yeah, today it's also a little better in Berlin. So everybody have a great day and a great weekend. Thanks to everybody for listening as well. And we'll see you next time with another founder journey in the Web3 space.